Okay, well, thank you very much for coming along today. My name is Ian Robinson. I work for Thoughtworks in the UK. I've been there 6 or 7 years now. I'm going to talk today about RESTful Application Protocol. Just a bit of background, the kind of work that I've done in the past. Like I said, I've been with Thoughtworks for 6-7 years now. During that period, I spent some time with the Patterns and Practices group in Redmond. It was about 5 years ago, I'd say now. Helping build out enterprise integration patterns using Microsoft technologies. And we documented that in a book called Integration Patterns, and then something called the Applied Integration Baseline, which I think has now been deprecated, but it's still available online. Then several years ago, I contributed towards the Thoughtworks anthology. I wrote an article called Consumer-Driven Contracts, which was really about building service-oriented systems and establishing contracts between service providers and consumers that came down to exchanging tests between those service providers and consumers. So helping drive out service contracts by consumers providing expectations of what it is that they wanted or needed. But over the last few years, together with a friend and colleague at Thoughtworks, Jim Weber, and another friend at Microsoft, Sabas Parastidas, been looking at the ways in which we can use the web as a platform for building enterprise applications. A lot of that is based on the work that we at Thoughtworks have done with clients over the last few years. But the result of that is this book, REST in Practice, which was published earlier this month. And I've got a couple of copies here to give away at the end of the session. So, REST in Practice, we're really talking about building enterprise applications, but using the web and the web's technologies as a platform for doing that kind of work. In the book, we tried to create a representative scenario. We were looking for something that was reasonably interesting, a cute scenario that we could use throughout the book to illustrate some of the examples. Several years ago, Gregor Hope published an article called Starbucks Doesn't Use Two-Phase Commit, which he looked at a Starbucks coffee shop and described how the baristas and the cashiers and the customers, they can all achieve some useful and interesting business outcomes.
Please try. Yeah. This one works. If you want to swap,
should we do that?
I switched that.
Is that better?
There we go.
Oh, I'm sorry about that. Switch that off anyway. Okay, so I was just describing that the kind of scenario that we were using in REST in Practice, a kind of representative scenario that could help illustrate some of the material. Inspired by Gregor's article, Starbucks Doesn't Use Two-Phase Commit, we chose to take a coffee shop as an example. Some interesting little processes that take place in a coffee shop. So we have our own little coffee shop called RESTbucks. We have to imagine that RESTbucks exists in a world of little robots, because you wouldn't really run a coffee shop based on web applications or HTTP or anything like that. But if you can imagine a coffee shop in a world of little robots where we're just exchanging HTTP messages backwards and forwards, and that helps drive a lot of the processes. So in some of the examples that you're going to see later on, you will see the name RESTbucks crop up because I've decided to continue pursuing those kind of examples. So I said that the talk today is really about RESTful application protocols. Well, what do I mean by an application protocol? Well, what in the book we call a domain application protocol. Can I just confirm that you can hear me better now? Is that
okay?
All right, so what do we mean by a domain application protocol? And why would it be of interest to us as designers and implementers of a RESTful web application? Well, if we look at this very, very simple process here. This is just kind of a logical or abstract diagram illustrating some of the interactions necessary in order to satisfy a kind of procurement process. So the customer requests a quote from a supplier. If they're happy with that quote, they place an order. The supplier may confirm that order, and then we have the ability to be able to pay for it. And at the same time, we also have the option to cancel that order. These interactions have to take place in a determinate order in order to realise an interesting or useful business outcome. So there's a set of rules guiding these interactions between the supplier and the customer. And those rules really comprise a protocol. So some very simple definitions of terms that I use quite often. These aren't necessarily textbook definitions, but they're things that I find useful day to day. So application protocol and application state. So typically we think of an application as a piece of software that, if started, has the potential to realize some useful business outcome. But for me, an application is actually a running instance. It's computerized behavior that helps achieve a user or client goal. Okay. So it's computer behavior, it's computing in action. So the running instance is the application. An application protocol is the set of rules that guide and constrain the interactions between participants in a distributed application. So it's the rules that guide those interactions in order to realize that useful application outcome or application goal. So I've illustrated that with a picture of the British Highway Code from many, many years ago. So here we've got an application protocol, a set of rules that help guide and constrain the interactions between all the different participants within the transport network within the UK. And it allows them all to coordinate their interactions so they can all achieve some useful outcome, you know, get from A to B. And then application state, well, over the course of an application, so an application has duration, it takes place in time. And at the end of that application, hopefully, we've achieved our goal, we've achieved that useful client goal. So that's the final or terminal application state. But over the course of the application will transition through several other application states. So we can take a kind of snapshot, a point in time view of the state of the overall distributed application and say, well, it's in this state or that state, or it's in the final terminal state where we've ideally realized that useful outcome. So I've got a snapshot here of, you know, a number of different vehicles that are all coordinating their interactions. At this particular point in time, we can say, well, this is the state in which that overall distributed application is. You know, that's the state that it's in. So we can take that previous diagram, that simple procurement process, and we can show the several different states that the overall application moves through in order for the customer to be able to order some goods and pay for them. And there's a separate process that takes place after this, that fulfillment process whereby we actually deliver the goods to the customer. This is simply the procurement process for ordering and paying for those goods. But we can see that at a certain point in time, the overall application is in the state of a quote having been requested. Customer requests a quote, and then we can say that the application is in the state of a quote having been requested. The customer is happy with that quote, they order, and then we say the application is in the state of the goods having been ordered. Confirm, transition to order confirmed, and then we've got the option whether to pay or to cancel. And if we pay, then this particular procurement application transitions into that paid state, that's the final state. And we've achieved our user goal at this point in time. So okay, this diagram has nothing to say about any particular implementation of the protocol. It's a very abstract or logical representation of the several different states that this application can transition through over the course of time. We've got then some choices to make about how we actually go about implementing this protocol. What kinds of consumers do we build? What kinds of providers do we build? And how do we actually coordinate some of the interactions between those participants so that we can achieve this goal? Well, one way that we can do it, and the way that we've often done it in the past, the kind of stuff that we did when I was working with the Patterns and Practices group, is to create something like a composite service or a composition service. Okay. So here we have one large service that encapsulates that application protocol state machine. It doesn't necessarily represent it as an application protocol state machine internally. Traditionally, it's something more like a sequential workflow diagram or something like that. But we can see that this service effectively coordinates all of those interactions, and it manages some of the interactions with downstream services and back-end applications. So the customer can go to one well-known endpoint, and then continue to interact with this composition service. You know, imagine something like a BizTalk orchestration. And that orchestration is then coordinating interactions with the product catalog, the warehouse, and perhaps with the payment provider. So we've taken that application protocol state machine and we've baked it into the server. We've put it on the server side. And we make that service responsible for managing all of those transitions. And then we can actually publish our protocol. We can say, this is the set of interactions that we expect to take place. And this is the order in which those interactions must take place in order to achieve this goal. In the Beeple world, we can actually publish a public process document or an abstract document that captures all of those public interactions that have to take place between the customer and the supplier service. So we actually publish a BPAL document and that's part of our protocol. So in the WSR BPAL world, the way in which we actually publish and execute protocols is by way of things such as BPAL, WSDL, and XML schema. These are all the kinds of public documents that we make available in order to advertise our protocol. That's one option. I've been interested, like I say, the last few years, of alternative ways of implementing those protocols using the web as an application platform. So what I want to do for a second is just look at the difference between operation-oriented design and resource-oriented design. Because what we want to do is to take that abstract protocol state machine and achieve those state transitions using a resource-oriented design. But with an operation-oriented design, which is what we're just looking at with that deposition service, we have one well-known, one giant monolithic resource, the service. And then we create a number of proprietary operations, as many as are needed, in order to execute that protocol, to advertise and execute that protocol. So here we are, we've got one large resource, one well-known endpoint, you know, we've got a URI or something like that, and we're sending messages to that URI, and they're being dispatched to all these different proprietary operations. With a resource-oriented design, we create a large number of resources. I've illustrated several here, a quote, an order, an item. And each of those resources exposes a uniform interface, a well-understood, well-defined set of operations. It's effectively a closed set of operations. So we want to try and implement our protocol, implement our application using a larger set of resources, each of which adheres to a uniform interface. And with a RESTful web application, that uniform interface is HTTP. It's HTTP's verbs, its status codes, and its headers. That's the interface with which that we use to interact and manipulate those resources. So again, just drilling down on this difference between operation-oriented and resource-oriented design. I think every application that we build, there's something special about it. It's trying to capture the semantics of a very specific business process. So there's some kind of specialization or innovation that we need to inject into our application in order to do what our end users and our customers require of us. And I'd say that specialization and that innovation depends upon there being at least one open set somewhere in our design. So at the top here, this is our operation-oriented design. We've got that closed set of one well-known resource, the service. But then we give ourselves the freedom to create an unlimited number of proprietary operations. That gives us the flexibility to model and execute the protocol. Yeah. Ideally, at the bottom, what we have here is our open set of resources. We're free to create as many resources as we want in a resource-oriented design. But each of them implements this uniform interface. That uniform interface is relatively constrained. It's a reasonably closed set. But we give ourselves the freedom to create as many resources as are necessary in order to model different parts of the protocol and to advertise it and then to execute it at runtime. The worst thing that we can do if we're trying to move to a resource-oriented design and build a RESTful web application is effectively handcuff ourselves by saying, well, I know that there's a small, limited, specific number of resources. And typically, people get into this mindset when they start thinking their resources have to be modeled explicitly on their domain entities. They think, well, there's a relatively closed set of domain entities and I just want to expose them immediately as resources. But I'm going to manipulate them using a closed set of verbs, closed set of operations. At that point, we've effectively closed off the opportunity to introduce specialization and innovation into our application. So there'll be a lot of RESTful designs or people seeking to build RESTful applications, and we get into a bit of a tangle because we think, well, I've got a customer here, and I want to do something other than just create a customer or delete it or update it. I've got some more specialized stuff that I want to do. How on earth can I do that using just these small number of verbs? Well, actually, the point is we give ourselves the opportunity to create additional resources that expose and adapt the protocol for a web-like environment. And we'll see some of that in the examples later on in the session. So we might start off with a number of domain entities and think, okay, we'll expose those as our resources. But we begin to introduce other resources, things like order forms, request for quote forms, which we'll see shortly, in order to help expose this protocol over the web. So what we want to do is to build an application whereby the client interacts with a community of resources and manipulates those resources. And the overall effect of manipulating those resources is to transition the distributed application through those several different application states. The question then arises, well, how do we actually coordinate some of these interactions with those resources? How do we ensure that a client can adhere to that protocol and not go off the path? Ensure that each of those interactions is legitimate at a particular point in time. And this is where we introduce REST's notorious hypermedia constraint. So if you've read the REST thesis or heard about it elsewhere, hypermedia as the engine of application state. This rather gnomic phrase that's often used to bash people over the head. You know, if you don't understand what this phrase means, then really you shouldn't be asking the question. It's kind of really on the inside or the outside. I think it's better to paraphrase and say, you know, hypermedia is the engine of application state. We can say, well, actually this really means that hypermedia systems transform application state. So earlier on, we were looking at that application protocol state machine. We saw the several different states that the overall distributed application had transitioned through. And we're going to ensure that our overall distributed application, the client and a large number of resources, can affect those state transitions by way of hypermedia. So here I've illustrated what I mean by a hypermedia system. So these are several different components within the system and a number of systemic behaviors or systemic interactions. So we have a client, and the client sends a request to a resource that's hosted by a server. And we have a number of different resources, and they can be hosted by a number of different servers. They don't all necessarily have to be situated within the same server or the same process. But we send a request to a resource that's identified by a URI. The server governing that resource interprets the request and then generates a representation of that resource's state and sends it as a response back to the client. So that representation might be a piece of XHTML, might be some JSON. One thing that's important, so it's got effectively a business payload, it's got some business information in it. But the other thing that it has some hypermedia controls, links and forms. So we include links and forms in the representation of resource state that we send back to the client. And those controls, those links and those forms advertise opportunities to interact with additional resources. So we're advertising legitimate interactions there and then in that resource representation. So the client receives the representation, parses it, and given that the client knows where it's headed, it's got a goal in mind, the client can interpret that response, identify the most appropriate control at this point in time, and activate it. Effectively click the link or fill out the form and submit the form. and then that generates the next request. And this has the effect, the side effect, of transitioning that distributed application through its several different states. So the client's interacting with resource state, just the state of an individual resource, but in doing so, identifying a particular hypermedia control, activating it, generating a second request. You know, as a third-party observer, we can say, well, this application has transitioned from one state to another. And I'll illustrate that in more detail again later in this session, so it's not just an abstract description. So I've talked about those hypermedia controls, links and forms. This is an overall hypermedia system, and we have to think of it in terms of a system, not only the components, but some of the behaviours. And it's the workings of this system that will transform the application through those several different states. But one part of that system are these hypermedia controls, links and forms. So what I've got here are several different representations of links. We're familiar with the anchor tag from HTML. HTML also defined the link element, and that was then adopted by the atom syndication format, and it's been adopted by several other representation formats elsewhere. So, second example here. OpenSearch also defines its own version of a link. So here we've got a URL element with a URI template, actually, at the bottom here. But again, this is effectively representing a link, the opportunity to click a link and get back representation of another resource located elsewhere. So the point here is we can represent links in several different ways. We're familiar with anchor tags and link elements, but we're also free to create our own representations of links. The nice thing is that we can adopt some of these well-understood formats, and that makes it easier to build some of our applications. Similarly, we've got forms. We've got an HTML form at the top there, and then at the bottom, I've got something that I've taken from the XForm specification. So the XForm specification is really, it's an XML vocabulary and a processing model for creating rather more sophisticated forms in browser-based and web applications. It uses effectively a model view controller way of working with forms and creating them. The important thing here, and I've highlighted it in both of these examples, is that we have a large amount of control data actually embedded in the form. So with a link, we know that at the minimum what we can do with a link is get it. You know, we can just issue an HTTP GET request on a link, and we'll get back a representation of a resource that's located at the end of that link. With a form, there might be other HTTP idioms that we need to use in order to interact with that form or to submit that form. Is it necessarily going to be a post, or could we use a put? So here we've actually got some control data. We've actually inlined some of those HTTP idioms. We've specified inline how we expect the client to use HTTP in order to complete and submit this form. So at the top here, the action attribute gives us the URI where we're expected to submit it. The method attribute gives us the HTTP verb, and the ENC type gives us the media type. This is how we're expected to encode the data that we submit to that endpoint. So we've inlined all of this control data there and then. And a client that understands this format can fill out the form, encode it, and submit it to the correct endpoint. We've got similar stuff in the XForms model here. So we've got control data down the bottom. The resource this time identifies the URI where we're expected to submit the form. Again, we've got the method, we've got the media type, this is how we're expected to encode the information. We've also got a schema attribute, an optional schema attribute here, because here we've the option or the ability to be able to submit XML when we're posting this form. And here we've said that whatever XML that we create on the client side and submit must conform to this schema. So there's a schema located at rfq.xsd, and we can create some form content, some form data that conforms to that schema. But the point is we've actually inlined a lot of that control data. We haven't had to define it and specify it up front in some contract document. we're actually defining a lot of it at runtime and including it in the form itself. Now, throughout, I'm really talking about machine-to-machine interactions. When we're users of the human web, we intuitively understand a link and what it means. You know, I see a link on a page, and based on the link text and some of the surrounding content, I know, or I've got a reasonable expectation of what's going to happen when I click that link. So I effectively understand the semantic of that link. It's just a kind of intuitive understanding. It's a lot more difficult for machines to infer semantics based on just some implicit context. So we have to give machines a bit more help. Help them understand the semantic context of the link. Why on earth would it be interesting or useful to you at this point in time to click this link or to fill out this form? What's the semantics of the link? Why is it important to you? So here we need to create some kind of semantic context. And again, there are several different options available to us. We can use micro formats, RDF, RDFA, things like that. Something that again was introduced in HTML and was adopted by Atom is the link relation. It's the rel attribute you see here on these two links. And the link relation value here, payment or RV order form, this is effectively a key into a semantic. So we can define that semantic elsewhere in some out-of-band documentation, and then we're effectively keying off that semantic here in the link relation value. We've got two different kinds of link relation value. We've got registered link relation values. These are things well-known, well-understood link relation values that have been registered with the Internet Assigned Numbers Authority. They maintain the Atom Registry of Link Relations. There's currently a web linking draft from Mark Nottingham that's proposing effectively extending the remit of that registry. But this is a well-known online registry maintained by IANA, where we can define the semantics of some of these link relations. So payment is a registered link relation. So we see a payment rel attribute, and we know that at the other end of that link, effectively this is saying that at the other end of that link is a resource where payment is accepted. That's the semantic, and the key is that simple string token, payment. Okay, so that's they're well understood, registered link relations. But within the bounds of our own organization, we might want to create some additional proprietary semantics, perhaps we want to create some proprietary link relations. This is what we call extension link relations. And the idea here is that the key is a URI. Now I've used a compact URI form here, but that could effectively be expanded, and you'll see that again in the examples. That could be expanded to say https://relations/order form. It's simply a key into a semantic we've defined elsewhere that says, at the other end of this link, any link that's been attributed with this order form link relation, at the other end of that link is a resource where orders may be submitted. So if we can program our client to recognize a number of these link relations, and if we advertise our protocol in part based upon these link relations, then ideally the client can understand, well, what's the most appropriate link to click or the most appropriate form to fill out at this particular point in time, given where it is that I'm headed, and given my understanding of what it is that I've achieved to date. So this is one way of providing some semantic context for those hypermedia controls in order to enable machine-to-machine interactions. So just in summary, the anatomy of a hypermedia control. We've got those link relations, the keys into semantics we've defined elsewhere. They help answer the question, why access this resource at this particular point in time? What does it mean to you? We've got the address, the URI, where does this link resource reside on the network? And then we've got the media type, which tells us, well, how ought I to interpret the response? When the response comes back, this is an indicative media type. This is saying you can expect to get something back that corresponds to this media type. And that media type specification, that is again keyed off this value here, will tell us how we can interpret the response. What kind of schemas can we expect? What are the meaning of several of those different elements? Things like that. So I said, in that hypermedia system, client sends a request, the server governing the resource interprets the request, generates a representation of resource state, sends it back, includes a number of links and forms, and then the client interprets that response based on its understanding of where it's headed and where it is right now. This is another way of thinking about those client behaviors within that hypermedia system. We can think of them as little agents. And they receive a response, and that response got a business payload, and it's got some links and some forms, and those links ideally have been typed, they've been given some semantic context. The client parses that response, parses the business payload, and in doing so, it may be applying a number of rules. So we're applying a number of rules across that payload. And if one of those rules fires, it generates an event. So this is the way in which agents behave. So it generates an event. We need something to handle that event. We need an event handler. Well, in this context, our hypermedia controls are event handlers. So we generate, we receive this response here. Again, I've had to align some of the details, but we'll see this in more detail later on. The client interpreting it realizes, okay, I'm at the point where I now need to make a payment. That rule fires. So we generate this event payment require or payment. So we're trying to match that to something in the response, and we find a hypermedia control that has been annotated payment. So that's the control that we decide to activate. So we follow that link. So we've got agents and events, and the hypermedia controls themselves are the event handlers. What we're talking about now, though, are interactions with resources and manipulating resources. So when we looked at that composition service, I said what we've effectively done is take the application protocol state machine and we've baked it into the server. We've taken it onto the server side and we've made the server and the service responsible for maintaining application state. So the server remembers something about the conversation that it's having with particular clients. And maybe it's not keeping all of that stuff in memory, it's persisting that information to a database. We're hydrating and rehydrating orchestrations. But we're maintaining this application state there on the server side. We're making the service responsible for application state and for the rules for the protocol itself. When we talk about a RESTful web application, at best, we need the client to manage and maintain application state. That the client has a fair understanding of what state this overall application is in. On the server side, we're simply interested in resource state. The servers that govern resources are simply interested in the state of individual resources. And no one of those resources need know about the overall state of the application. So we've got some rules that effectively constrain the states that individual resources can go through, and the servers can apply those rules, but the servers aren't necessarily interested in application state as such. I mean, we have to be a third-party observer or a client in order to see the application and the way in which it transitions through these separate application states. So what I've tried to indicate here is that the application protocol state machine and those transitions just emerge as a side effect of the client interacting with individual resources and manipulating individual resources and resource state. Okay, so these are some of the very simple states that some of those resources might move through. We interact with a quote, or we interact with an order, and the server governing that order knows that this individual order can transition from created to awaiting fulfillment. But it doesn't know anything else about the rest of the protocol. Know lots of other rules and lots of other resources that it may not know about at all, and that's fine. So I said, with that composition service, the way in which we advertise, document, and execute a protocol is by way of things such as BPEL. So we use abstract BPEL documents to advertise and publish the protocol. We use BPEL very often on the inside of a service in order to, maybe use a BPEL engine or an orchestration engine in order to execute the stuff on the server side. So BPEL documents, WSDL to advertise some of the capabilities of the endpoints, an XML schema to describe the formats of some of the messages that are exchanged. So see, these are some of the public artifacts that we use with when documenting and executing a protocol in a service-oriented fashion. With a RESTful protocol, we have several different artifacts that we use. So we document our protocol in terms of media types. We say, well, these are the different media types that we support. And if you can build a client that understands these media type specifications, you can parse and create representations according to these media type specifications. Well, that's one part of our protocol. We document it in addition using link relations. We say, look, these are the link relations that we use to provide some semantic context for individual controls. So again, if your client understands these link relations, then it will be able to parse responses and identify individual controls and work out which ones to activate. And then we also need to specify some of the HTTP idioms that a client needs to use in order to manipulate specific resources. Is it appropriate to use a post here or a put? What kind of headers might the client need to supply? And what kind of headers might it expect back or status codes might it expect to receive in a response? Now, we can create some of these as part of a protocol specification, or we can use ones that have been defined elsewhere. So there are lots of media type specifications already available to us. And ideally, we take advantage of those, things like XHTML or ATOM. These are a great basis for building our applications, rather than having to invent our own formats. Actually, what I'm going to show you is an example where I have invented my own format. And we can adopt some of those link relations that have been defined elsewhere. So again, we might go to that registry of ATOM link relations and pick some of the stuff there if it's appropriate. If not, we can create our own proprietary ones and document and advertise those. So to give a bit more detail to that, let's look at the ATOM publishing protocol. So there's the ATOM syndication format specification, which defines the ATOM format itself, and then there's the ATOM publishing protocol, two different specifications. And the ATOM pub protocol is really an application protocol that helps us achieve the overall goal of publishing web content. That's its purpose. ATOM pub is there to help us publish and manipulate web content. And the ATOM syndication format is simply a representation format, an XML vocabulary for ATOM feeds and ATOM entries. So at the bottom here, bottom left, we've got the ATOM syndication format, application/ATOM+XML. That's the media type value that you'll find in the content type header, and that's saying that the response that you're getting back can be interpreted according to the ATOM syndication format. And that syndication format has got a couple of RelaxNG schemas that describe ATOM feeds and ATOM entries. So when we get an ATOM response back, we know that we can interpret it according to one or other of those schemas. The ATOM syndication form also says, look, of all the elements that I've defined, one of them is very, very special. It's the link element. This is my version of a hypermedia control. So if ever you're looking for hypermedia controls in an ATOM entry or an ATOM feed, look for link elements, and link elements that have rel attributes. So it calls out one of the elements as being particularly special. And then it also defines five of its own link relations. These were the founding link relations for the ATOM registry. So it defines self, alternate, via, enclosure, and related. And the semantics for those are now registered with IANA. Okay, so that's ATOM syndication format. And then along comes the ATOM publishing protocol. And it says, okay, we've got an overall goal in mind of publishing web content. Now, that could be any kind of content, news stories, blog articles, photos, other kinds of digital media. but we need some kind of protocol, some set of rules that enable clients and servers to interact in order to publish web content. And the publishing protocol is defined in exactly the terms that I've just talked about. It says, okay, we're going to use atom feeds and atom entries effectively as envelopes for the content that we want to publish. So we're going to reuse a media type that's defined elsewhere. But we're also going to create a couple of additional media types, these two up here, atom SVC and atom cat plus XML. So these are two additional documents that you'll find as part of an atom pub server. And the first one effectively is a service document that advertises some of the capabilities. But these are just very simple schemas, very simple document formats. And if you see a response with a media type of one of these, you effectively know how to interpret it according to the protocol. AtomPub also defines a couple of additional link relation values. So it defines edit and edit media. And again, it standardizes those and publishes those with the Atom link. Atom registry link relations. And then it also said, okay, so you're creating content, you're creating entries, and these entries are little envelopes really for the web content you want to publish. AtomPub tells you how to manipulate those entries using specific HTTP links. So it says once you've created an entry, you can modify it using an HTTP put, or you can delete it using a delete. So upfront, actually, in the specification itself, we've got a lot of detail about which HTTP idioms to use in order to manipulate those entries. But in contrast to BPEL, we're still an XML schema. We've got media types, link relations, and HTTP idioms. These are the things that we use to advertise and document our protocol. So AtomPub documents itself in exactly these terms. If you look at Sun's Cloud API, it does it in exactly the same way again. It defines a number of different media types, a number of link relations, and it tells you which HTTP idioms you can use to manipulate resources. So very often, we see people publishing RESTful APIs, and we see some of the documentation, and that documentation often includes things like URI templates. You want to manipulate this customer, fill out this template. It's /customer/ and the customer ID. We want to fill that in at runtime. And that's the way in which a lot of applications document themselves and document their protocol. You see that there's none of that here. We're not specifying any URI templates. We're not saying, look, this is our URI space and this is how you interact with us, and your client needs to know something about specific URI structures. The client can always treat URIs as opaque and understands what they mean based on these link relation values. It doesn't have to infer anything from the URI structure itself. So we document ourselves simply in these terms. So when we were writing the book, we looked back at some of the things that we'd done in the past, and we reflected on some of the work that we were doing with the RESTbox scenario. And we came up with a three-step model for designing and implementing these kind of RESTful application protocols. We said the first thing that we can do is think about our application, think about the process that we want to automate. And we may very well model it as an application state machine, that kind of application state machine that we saw earlier. Okay, so that's a logical or an abstract description of our application. And that helps us identify corner cases, it helps us identify specific states that the application transitions through, and each of those transitions may in and of itself generate some value for the end user or for the organization that's exposing this application. Now, if we were to build a composition service, then typically we would take that application state machine and somehow or another we'd bake it into the server on the server side. That's not what we do here. Instead, what we want to do is to implement our application in terms of resources and resource life cycles and some of the rules that the servers governing those resources know about that associate one resource with another. So the server that's governing an individual resource may very well know that this resource is linked or connected to other resources. And it may have some rules that constrain the several different states that resource can transition through. So we have to try and identify some of those states for those resources and some of the rules that associate them or link them to other resources. And then we advertise and we execute our application using media types, link relations, and HTTP links. So we're becoming more and more specific as we go down that list. Now the thing is, in practice, step one is often optional. I think there are application protocols everywhere, but lots of them are very, very trivial. If you think of a data service, where all we want to do actually is expose entities, create them, update them, and delete them, well, CRUD is a very, very simple protocol. But it's so simple, so trivial, that typically we don't reflect on it. We don't model it explicitly in terms of these state machines. That's fine. But when our protocols are a little more interesting, our processes are a little more interesting, it's often worth our while just spending a little time modeling them explicitly as an application state machine. And if it's amenable to being modeled as an application state machine, then it's likely that we can implement it in the way which I'm going to describe now. Steps two and three tend to be done in an iterative fashion. So I start off with a kind of candidate list of resources that I think I'm going to need. And then I start very quickly trying to model some of these specific interactions, thinking about specific representations. And what I will discover is that I need to introduce additional resources. So I'm not constraining myself, I'm not shackling myself to thinking of a closed set of resources. I'll discover, as I work my way through several examples, I'll discover additional resources that I might need to introduce in order to capture all of the semantics of my application. So what we're going to do now is work through effectively those three steps for that very simple procurement process that we looked at the beginning. So we've already done step one, we've modelled it in terms of an application protocol state machine. And then I can start thinking about some of the candidate resources. I know I'm going to be dealing with a quote, and so likely I'm going to have a collection of quotes. I want to create an order, so again, it may very well be that I have a collection of orders, and there's also going to be a paper. So I'm thinking in the first instance, really, along the lines of my domain and domain entities that I might want to expose or adapt for the network. But very quickly, I start trying to think, okay, how is the client actually going to interact with this application? So we get started. So every application needs at least one well-known entry point. One well-known URI that we can publish and say, look, this is the entry point to my application. It's Amazon's homepage, for example. I go to Amazon's homepage, and then from there, I can work my way through the rest of the application. I can realize my goal of ordering and paying for books, buying books online, by clicking on links and filling out forms. But I know that the first place that I can go to is Amazon's homepage. It's the same here. So RestBooks exposes one well-known URI, restbooks.com/shop. So a client does a get on /shop, and this is the response that we get back. So we've created, for the purpose of our example, a custom media type. So we'll have a media type specification somewhere, and that's keyed off this value, application/vnd.restbooks+XML. And in that media type specification, we'll say, look, here are some of the schemas, so the responses that come back will be XML, but they'll be conformant with these schemas. We've said that within these responses, there are a couple of things that you should look for: XForms forms and link elements, because these are your hypermedia controls. And we'll also define some additional link relations. And all of that is effectively encapsulated in that media type specification. Okay. So we've got a response, and we've indicated that it's application in the RestBooks+XML. Very simple entity body containing one link. So these entry point URIs and these entry point resources, effectively, this is the opportunity to advertise some of the capabilities that we support within our application. So if in the future we wanted to introduce some search functionality, this is the place where we could advertise that. When customers come back again, and come into our application through /shop, we might have an additional link that says at the other end of this link you can find a search form. We now support search. At the moment we're just advertising one capability. It's this one link that's been annotated rb:img. Remember, this is a compact URI, but the semantic behind this is saying at the other end of this link is something that you can use to create a request for a quote. It's a form that you can fill out to create a request for a quote. We've also made this cacheable. So we've made it cacheable for up to one day. So So this response can be cached throughout the caching infrastructure. Proxies, reverse proxies, local caches. So if we've got lots of customers coming to our shop, most of these responses serving up the homepage will come out of the caching infrastructure. We're not taxing the shop itself very much. So we can see at this point that our overall, so we're a third party observer, we can see that our overall distributed application has transitioned into the starting state. So we're going to see a number of these diagrams throughout the example. And effectively the arcs, the arrows, represent requests, and the nodes at the end of the arcs represent a response. And then the dotted boxes, what we've done is superimpose the application states. So remember, we're not baking application state into the server, but as a third-party observer, we can say, look, this is the state that the overall application is in at this point in time. So we're in the starting state. And we've got a document with one typed link, RB colon RFQ. So we've employed a couple of strategies here. We've got an entry point resource that we can use to advertise capabilities. And we've started introducing caching. So we're storing infrequently changing representations closer to the client. And this helps conserve bandwidth, reduce latency, and reduce the load on the origin server. So these are a couple of the strategies that we've started employing here. There's only one way to go at this point in time. We're advertising one capability. So the client can issue a GET request against that type link, restbox.com/requestable quote. And this is what we get back. We get back a response containing an XForms form. Again, the content type here is application, BND, restbox plus XML. So again, within that media type specification, we say, whenever you get a response back according to this media type, you can expect to see something that either begins with a shop element or with an XForms model element. These are the two things that you can expect to get back. So we've given back a form. You notice there aren't any form fields here. This is for machine-to-machine interactions, and form fields often feel a bit, they're useful for the human web, not so useful for us here. Instead, we've got some control data at the bottom that tells us at runtime what HTTP idioms the client needs to use in order to activate this form. But we've also provided that schema element, that schema attribute, sorry. And that's pointing to an XML schema that says, look, you're going to fill out this form and post back some XML formatted content, and that content has to adhere to this schema. And we've got the empty instant element that says that this is the part of the form idea that you should be filling out. You just need to substitute this with something that conforms to that schema. So we've provided, at runtime, a lot of control data. We've given the client enough information that it needs, as long as it understands this media type. We've given it enough information so that it can fill out and submit this form. And again, it's a blank form, so we make it cacheable. We can serve up lots of blank forms from the caching infrastructure. So we've used a little strategy here I call type link to form. What I tend to do to help create some kind of semantic context for forms is to advertise them in a prior resource. So we had a typed link in that entry point resource that was typed RFQ. And we said at the other end of this link is a form that allows you to submit a request for a quote. And the client followed that link, and in following it, it retains all of that context. It retains that knowledge. Okay, now I'm dealing with a form that helps me request a quote. So the client knows what it's doing here and now based on that previous link relation. So the client fills out the form. It composes a request for a quote according to that schema. And we post it. Again, we're using that control data, and we post it to slash quotes. So we're ordering a couple of different types of coffee here. 250 grams of Costa Rican tonzu and some Guatemalan elephant beans. Okay. So we post that quote to slash quotes. And this is the response we get. So that quotes collection has created for us a new resource. And it indicates that it's done that using 201 created. So we're using the status code to indicate that we've created a new resource. And we've also included a location header This is the location of the new resource that I've just created for you. /quotes/1234. Helpfully, in the response, we've also included a representation of that newly created resource. So we could either have redirected the client, that's what we do on the human web, we do a 303 redirect. But here, we're just including the response directly in the 201 created response. So we're including a representation of that newly created quote. So again, it's formatted. We've kind of got this reasonably generic representation format. Most of the stuff you'll see is either an XForms form or it's a shop element with one or more items within an items collection and then a number of links. I had to elide the item elements, but effectively we're reflecting back what it is that the customer or the client has requested, and we've included some prices. These are the quotes, the prices that we've quoted. And we've included two type links. We've included this self link, which is one of those registered link relations. This is effectively just a link pointing back to the quote. And then we've included another type link, which is RB colon order form. And again, to find the semantic, perhaps on a wiki, somewhere within our organization, we said, if you see a link that's attributed RB colon order form, you know that the other end of that is a form that you can fill out in order to order what it is that we've just quoted. The nice thing is, because, I mean, if we expand that link relation, it's a URI. Perhaps we could actually put some of that human readable documentation at the end of that URI. So we're making more and more of our protocol of the web. We're putting it on the web. Anyway, so at this point, in posting that quote to quotes and receiving the response with those two type links, self RB order form, we can see that the overall distributed application has now transitioned from the started state into the quote requested state. Now, when we did that initial get on request for quote, we were actually moving through steady state. We were enriching the client's understanding of the current state of the application. We weren't changing application state, we were just enriching the client's understanding of the current state of the application. But then when we posted to quotes, at that point, the overall application did transition from started into quote requested. So again, several different strategies. We use type link to form, type link in one response leading to a form, and that provides the semantic context. We understand why on earth we've come to that form and what it means to submit and operate that form. Within the form itself, we provided some inline control data. That effectively allows us to specify at runtime which HTTP idioms the client can use, rather than fixing it all up front in some protocol document. So maybe, I mean, we look back at the AtomPub specification, and there in the specification that you can read online, you'll see it defining some of those HTTP idioms. It's effectively fix those idioms up front. Whereas if we've been able to provide all that information at runtime, we're actually providing for a slightly more dynamic environment. And we used just posting to a collection. That collection was responsible for creating effectively a subordinate resource. So there are three different strategies employed here. So imagine that the client, it's either happy with the quote or it goes and gets some other quotes from elsewhere, from some other suppliers. At some point it's happy with the quote it's received, so it decides to place an order. Well, we've got a type link that says at the other end of this is a form that we can use to place an order. So we do a get on that. What we receive back is another form. This one's slightly different because we've pre-populated it. We've actually filled out the entire form on behalf of the client. So we've provided all the information necessary to supply to the order processor. We've provided all of that in line. So instead of passing around references to quotes, we're passing around the quote itself. And we want to post that to the order processor, so the order processor can go away and actually create an order on our behalf. Again, we're using caching here. The interesting thing is, so Restbox has a little a business rule that says, once we've issued a quote, that quote is valid for 7 days. So we said, actually, we can make this order form itself cacheable for up to 7 days after it was first generated, after the quote was first created. So we've indicated that it's publicly cacheable, and that it expires, in fact, that expires 7 days after the quote was originally created. We're also indicating that the underlying data for this resource comes from quotes slash 1234. So we've got this content location header that's indicating actually the underlying data belongs to another resource located out there on the network, to that quote resource. I'm going to come back to that in a second. So we've filled out the body of the form, nothing for the client to do. We've provided some control data. Now, what I said is we're actually providing, you know, all of the quote data in line, so that when we post this form, everything that the order processor needs to process that quote and to create an order is included there and then in the request. Well, there's nothing to stop a malicious client from changing some of the inline quote data and effectively earning itself quite a significant discount. So if we were passing around references to quotes, that wouldn't be an issue, because when the order processor receives that reference to a quote, it would go away and discover what the quote was, but we want to actually pass around all the quote data. So what we've done is establish a trust relationship between the quoting engine and the order processor. So effectively public, private key, trust relationship. And the quoting engine has been able to hash the quote data and encrypt that hash, and then add that to the URI here. So when we're posting to this URI, we're encoding effectively a tamper-proofing mechanism. Now, we are coupling the quoting engine and the order processor. We're coupling them through this trust relationship, and we're also coupling them because now the quoting engine knows something about the URI structure that the order processor uses. It knows that it needs to create this URI with a particular format, semicolon T equals, and then the tamper-proofing cache. That's fine. If we're running all of this, if all of these resources are being run off the same server, that's not really a problem, because we as developers are governing this URI space internally. If the quoting engine and the order processor, the stuff that's governing all of the orders, are located elsewhere in the organization, we've got a coupling between those two different groups. And if we're crossing organizational boundaries, this is when this part of the solution becomes a bit more fragile. Because if the order processor wanted to modify the URI structure, we've got to go and modify some of our quoting code. So notice we have that content location header. The data here is coming from the same place as the quote itself. So what I discovered when I was working through the book is that, you know, very often there's a temptation just to naively expose domain entities and think that's our resource space. They're all the resources that we need. And then we come across rather more interesting parts of our process where just being able to CRUD on a domain entity doesn't really cut it. So I started thinking that the resources effectively adapt our domain for hypermedia clients. So we create as many resources as are necessary in order to expose the protocol in a web-friendly way, expose it so that clients that understand our media types and that understand our link relations can use it. So the quote itself, so we've got, you know, we're exposing it just through this RESTful interface. And then on the inside of our servers and our applications, we've got all of our domain knowledge and our domain data. The quotes representation was created off the back of that domain entity. So is the order form. These are effectively two different resources or two representations of the same underlying data, but they're adapting it for different purposes. One of them is just adapting the data to expose the quote, and the other is adapting it so that we can create an order. It's adapting it for a different purpose. So we've created a new resource, a protocol resource, which is an order form. We've introduced that into our model, and that's helped adapt our domain so that we can do something useful with it. So the client submits that order form. It posts the order to that URI with a little tamper-proofing mechanism. And you can see that all of the X forms scaffolding, the model, and the instance element and the submission date, all of that falls away. And what we post is just the body of that form. So this looks exactly like what we could have posted. We didn't necessarily have to go by way of the order form. If we knew somehow that what we needed to do in order to create an order was to post this quote data, we could have done that directly. The order form is a nice convenience that helps drive or program the client on the fly. But the overall effect on the wire, it looks just like another post. So we post that, all of the data necessary to create an order, to the orders processor. Now, turns out on the order processor, there are a few things that we need to do before we can set up an order in its initial state. We need to go away, we need to check the warehouse, check the stuff's in stock. We also need to contact a third-party payment provider to set up a transaction that the customer is going to complete later on. So some of these things can take a little while. Do we really want the client hanging around on an open connection, not even knowing whether its request has been received successfully or not? No. Instead, what we do is accept that request as soon as we can, and then we process it asynchronously. We queue it for subsequent processing. So we say, look, 202 accepted, we've received your request, but we haven't currently processed it. But you can be sure that we successfully received it. We're using HTTP here as a very simple coordination mechanism to guarantee the delivery. You know, the client knows that as soon as it receives this 202 accepted response, that we successfully accepted that request. And we also provide a location header that says, look, when we finally finished processing your request, the outcome will be available at this new resource, orders/9876. And in the entity body, we just include the very same data. We say, look, we're just initializing everything, we're setting it all up. But here's a link to what will eventually you can regard as the order in its initial state. So here we go. Again, we enriched our understanding of the current state, quote requested. So we got back the order form. We posted that, and then the application transitioned into the goods ordered state. Again, this is the third-party perspective. We can see that overall distributed application has transitioned from quote requested to goods ordered. So we supplied a pre-filled form with all the information necessary to create the order. We created effectively a one-time URI with a tamper-proofing mechanism based on a simple trust relationship between quoting and order processor. And we used 202 accepted for what was effectively a long-running activity so that we can successfully accept the request and then process it in our own time, but leave the client confident that we are doing something with it. So now the client, it's got that new location of the overall outcome of its order that it can now start polling. So immediately it does a get on orders/9876. Well, at this point, we're still either contacting the warehouse or setting up something with the payment provider. So we're not in a position to be able to return a representation of the order at this point. So we just return 404 not found. So again, we're coordinating some of these interactions with the client. We're saying, look, just back off for a while. So the client probably waits a couple of seconds and then does another get. So it's polling at regular intervals. Get orders/9876. And this time, everything has finally been satisfied behind the scenes, so we can now return a representation of this order. 200 OK. Here it is. So again, we've got something formatted according to application DND Restocks.xml. We've got that shop element. We've got all of the items. We've got four different typed links. And we've also got a status element saying this resource is in the state of awaiting payment. What else have we included? Okay. We've made this cacheable. This response is cacheable by the caching infrastructure. However, we also know that several different things are going to happen to this order. The client's going to interact with it, but other things are going to happen behind the scenes. That means that the order state is going to change over time. Now, the moment we introduce caching, we're moving into a world of eventual consistency or weak consistency. So if we start caching representations of this order and the client's continually hitting this for some reason or other, it may be that it starts seeing a representation of the order that's now out of date. So what we've done is say, actually, this expires immediately. It's publicly cacheable, but it expires immediately. So we can cache it from the caching infrastructure. But whenever we re-request it, that cache has to revalidate our request with the origin server and say, look, I've got a cache representation of this order, but I don't know whether it's fresh. Maybe it's out of date. Can you tell me whether it's out of date? I'm going to supply you with a little bit of information that tells you what the order looks like, the cache version that I've got, what it looks like, and you can tell me whether it's out of date or not. And if it's not out of date, I'll just release my cache representation, and that will save us a lot of bother. Because all we're doing, all that's taking place between the cache and the origin server at this point, we're just exchanging a few headers. If it has changed on the origin server, however, we want to release, we want the new representation to flow all the way from the origin server to the client. So the way that we do that, we provide this etag header. So etags, very simple, it's just an opaque string token that's effectively a checksum of the state of a resource at a particular point in time. It's a value that the server generates, and it associates with the state of the resource at the point that it generated that resource representation. If the resource changes on the server, then the server can generate a fresh etag value. And there are lots of different strategies that we can employ in order to generate those etag values. We can actually compute them by generating a representation of resource and then hashing it. That's probably the most expensive. We might use a file attribute, perhaps the date of a file, if we're actually storing this stuff in a file. If some of our underlying data is in a database where each of the rows has a version number, you know, a lot of object relational mappers will include version numbers with each row, we can actually use that version number as an etag value. It's got no semantic significance for the client. It's just an opaque string token. And then we can use these etag values, the client can use them, and the caches, the intermediaries can use them in a couple of different ways. They can use them with conditional gets. So this is the situation where you say, look, I've got a cached representation of this resource. I want you, the origin server, to give me a new version, but only if it hasn't changed since the last time I saw it. And the way that I can tell you whether what it looked like the last time I saw it is I can supply you with the etag value that you gave me when you last released that representation. So we can include an if num match header in our request and include that old etag value. And this is saying, return a full response, but only if the resource has changed. If it hasn't changed, just send back 304 not modified. So you can imagine, you know, we might have, you know, some large representations shuffling lots and lots of data around over the wire. But if it hasn't changed, well, we're sending back 304 not modified. We're conserving quite a bit of bandwidth. Clients can also use them to do effectively, it's a kind of optimistic concurrency strategy. And this is something that AtomPub uses. We can use them with conditional posts and conditional puts. So in this instance, the client can supply an if match header with that old etag value. And it's saying, look, apply this verb, process this request, but only if the resource hasn't changed since the last time I saw it. So if somebody else has interacted with our resource in the meantime, we want to know about it. And the server will know about it because we're supplying it with etag value from the last time we interacted with it. If it's changed, if the state has changed somewhere on the server because some other client has interacted with it, the server will have a new etag value, and so our precondition will fail. Process this request only if the resource hasn't changed. If it has changed, the server sends back 412 precondition failed. And at that point, the client can back off and say, okay, I best find out what state this resource is in. Does a fresh get, looks at it, decides, oh, actually, they've made the changes I wanted anyway. So I can. Or, actually, I still want to go ahead and modify. So again, coordination mechanism implemented through HTTP. Okay. So we started with our 202 accepted. We then started polling the value in that location header. And eventually, we were served up with a representation of the order. So we transitioned from goods order to order confirmed. We used polling. And the nice thing about polling, I mean, the web is optimized for polling. Most of the web is HTTP GETs. 90% or more of the way that he gets. Web is highly optimized for polling. That's what we're doing most of the day when we're reading, you know, blogs and newspapers and stuff online. We're just issuing gets. The nice thing about polling is it makes the client responsible for the successful delivery of a message. Other talks and elsewhere in the book, we talk about using atom feeds for event-driven systems. Typically, in an event-driven system, the publisher publishes events, and we depend either on the publisher or on some middleware to successfully guarantee the delivery of those notifications towards subscribers. But if the publisher instead just publishes an atom feed, we then make all the clients, all the people who are interested in finding out that stuff has changed, responsible for guaranteeing the delivery of those events. So they just keep polling that feed. And because they're events, they're immutable. So these feeds, if we can archive them very, very quickly, they can get cached in the caching infrastructure. And so a lot of the event notifications get served up from the caching infrastructure. The clients are polling, but they're actually being served up by the caching infrastructure. So the nice thing about polling is it makes the client responsible for the successful delivery of the notification. And at web scale, that's great. We use ETag for efficient re-querying, and we'll see that shortly. And then we use this cache but revalidate strategy, so that we effectively implement this trade-off between bandwidth usage and consistency. We do want clients to see the most consistently and the most up-to-date version of the resource, but if it hasn't changed, we want to be able to release a representation from a cache rather than send it all the way from the origin server to the client. So now we need to make a payment. Like I said, behind the scenes, we've already set up this transaction with a payment provider, third-party payment provider. That's what was taking up some time. And then we advertised a link to that specific transaction. So there's a protocol that took place behind the scenes between the order processor and the payment provider. We exchanged some information, and now we've got a link that we can advertise that leads to that transaction. So we advertise that in our order. The client decides it wants to pay for the order, so it follows that link. So now we're going to example.org/payments/1010. And we get back a form. And just for variety's sake, I've decided this is going to be an XHTML form. So this is a nice, human-friendly payment provider. It's just asking us really to fill out or supply our credit card details. But so the action, the URI where we're going to submit this form, we're posting back to ourselves. So this individual transaction can move through several different states of its own, and we post back the completed form back to the transaction and modify its own internal state. So the client supplies its credit card details, we post that back to the payment provider. Payment provider does whatever it needs in order to update the state of that individual payment. And then, again, because we'd set up all this beforehand in the interaction between the order processor and the payment provider knows of a callback URI where it can redirect the client. So it issues a 303 CEVA. Again, another really interesting idiom, because clients know when they see a 303 other, they can expect to find a location header in the response, and they can immediately issue a get against that location header. So again, we're using HTTP to coordinate the interactions between clients and servers. So we successfully submitted a payment. The payment provider redirects us back to RESTBUX. Okay, so now we're going to do a fresh get on an order. But because we're a well-programmed client, we remember that this order came with an ETAG the last time we saw it. So we're going to do a conditional get. Just send me back the full-blown response, the full-blown representation of this order, but only if it's changed since the last time I saw it. Well, it has. So, a lot earlier on, I said, okay, now we're dealing with resource-oriented design, resource life cycles. We're thinking in terms of resource life cycles, and we're thinking about some of the rules that the server knows about that relate one resource to another. Now, sometimes, usually the state of a resource is just a function of the data that's properly in that resource. But But occasionally, the state of a resource is also partly the function of the state of another resource that the server knows about, associated through some business rules. And that's the case with an order. An order is the state of an order is partly the function of the state of the payment with which it has been associated. And the server knows about this rule and can apply this rule, and it knows about the associated transaction because we set all that up behind the scenes. So it knows that the state of this order is partly a function of the state of the payment with which it's associated. So behind the scenes, we can go away, we can query that payment, and we discover, yep, the client has successfully made a payment. So now we can update our own internal state, our own order state. So yep, the order has changed. Conditional get, the order has changed, so we send back a full-blown response. So we see that the state of this order is now in the paid state, and we've generated a new e-tag because the state of the resource has changed. With that, I mean, that's probably the most complex of the transitions. We navigated to the payment provider, got back the order form, filled out the order form. We were then issued with a 303C other, and that redirected us back to our order. And at that point, we can see that not only is the order transitioned into a paid state, the state of an individual resource, the overall distributed application has also transitioned into that paid state. So transition from order confirmed to paid. So we saw an example here of actually composing a couple of application protocols and composing media types, because we've started handing off to a third party and incorporating their protocol in the very same process. I didn't put it post. So behind the scenes, the payment provider is implementing an idempotent post strategy. So post, conventionally, there's no guarantee that it's idempotent. Multiple requests, each of them can change the state of a resource. In this instance, that payment provider, because we're posting back to ourselves, we can update the state of the payment. We know it's transitioned to a paid state. And so the next time we receive a post, we'll refuse to accept it. We'll say we'll only accept posts whilst we're awaiting payment. Once we're in a paid state, we'll return a 405 method not allowed. Which is fine to kind of constrain the semantics of post on the server side. It's fine, again, we're using HTTP just to coordinate some of those interactions. And then we saw that the order, you know, is probably the most complex of our resources, because the state of that order is partly a function of the state of an associated resource, that payment itself. So here we go. We saw, through a number of different interactions, the overall distributed application transition through its several different states. We saw the client achieve a useful business goal, and yet all of that was simply by way of interacting with the community of resources and using hypermedia controls to guide and constrain the interactions leading from one resource to the next particular point in time. So I started off with a candidate list of resources that were very much based around my domain. But in working through some of these examples, I started introducing some additional resources, protocol resources. Now, the nice thing is most of these do map to nice domain concepts. Order form, you can imagine a pen and paper order form. But I wouldn't necessarily be constrained by that kind of thinking. These are whatever we need to introduce in order to adapt the protocol for consumption by a hypermedia client. So we introduced a number of different order forms. We didn't look at cancellation, but there's also another resource there that allows us to create cancellations. So we can document and advertise this protocol by saying, look, we support these media types. BND RESTbox plus XML. And for payments, for this third-party payment provider, you need to understand XHTML. We're adopting a couple of well-understood link relations, self and payment, so clients need to be programmed with those. And then we drop down into that media type specification and say, look, we've got a schema here. You can expect to see responses formatted according to this schema, with a shop element, status, items, collection of items, and a number of link controls. We said that you can identify hypermedia controls. They're either the link element that you'll see in those shops, or you can expect to receive an XForms model. And so we can actually direct people to the XForms specification. We're going to create a number of our own proprietary link relations, so we'll document those link relation semantics. And then we just say that there's a bit of a processing model that you need to understand in order to be able to handle some of this stuff, and most of that is encapsulated by the XForms core processing model. And that tells you how to interpret those models, how to interpret that control data, and how to fill out and submit those forms. So again, if you can program a client according to that, then you've got a lot of the processing capabilities necessary to execute this protocol. There's obviously a lot of other stuff that we need to put into that client. A lot of business rules that help the client parse the payload of all the representations and determine what it wants to do next. But we've given it all of the semantics and all the control data that needs in order to be able to do that. It turns out we've hit an hour and a half. So I was hoping that I'd do it in about an hour and a quarter and we could take a few questions, but I've actually probably gone over my own time. But if you do want to ask questions, either I don't know if there is time now, or if not, find me immediately afterwards or contact me on any of these addresses. I have to highlight the S because there are lots of other email business out there. We'll get each other's mail, so I've got an S because it's like everything I do. So I hope that was useful. Thank you very much for coming along.